board and a new pair of Vans. I don't care if there's one in the stands, 'cause I'll ride till it gets dark. Some might think that it's lame, but if you take a look around, it's the new ball game.
The Children's Hour is produced by the Children's Hour Incorporated, a New Mexico nonprofit.
Our show was written by Katie Stone, with lots of help from all of us on the Kids Crew.
You can find photos, links, learn-along guides, and more about us at childrenshour.org.
Our thanks to our guest, Byron Motley. Our learn-along guides are written by Jonathan Dunsky and had help this time from Lorraine Archibald. We had production support from Eli Henley and Chad Shear.
Find our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, or go to our patreon.com/thechildrenshour.
Or ask your smart speaker to play the Children's Hour podcast.
We post our photos and more on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Find us at TCH Radio.
Our theme music was written by C.K. Barlow.
The Children's Hour is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and by the Pacifica Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to the Children's Hour, Kids Public Radio.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio's final fundraising drive of 2022 was a tremendous success. Thanks to our listeners, our goal of $70,000 was exceeded. Stitching communities together brought folks together for the love of independent media. The beloved KBOO community extends gratitude to our members, supporters, staff, and board. And a big thank you to our volunteer programmers. Your on-air support was the backbone of this membership drive. Tax receipts are available. Please send a request to membership at kboo.fm. Since 1968, KBOO has relied on its members to support grassroots broadcasting. Thank you.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. Together, we like to call ourselves unlucky weirdos sometimes. But you are currently listening to Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Man, unlucky weirdos.
That's right.
For those that don't know, the uninitiated, Q and I, we started off DJs, and when we worked together, we called ourselves unlucky weirdos. I think that name is excellent still.
Yeah, we're bringing it back.
Yeah, but right now, Civic Cypher is in full effect. A lot to stick around for, so please do. Today, we are going to be talking about something. It's going to be a bit of a discussion. We're gonna open the floor up to our listeners. We will not profess to be experts, but it's something interesting that I think it's worth talking about. Again, we're going to discuss standpoint theory. Heard about this recently, and I thought it was important given a conversation I had recently. And also, we are going to spend some time talking about Ebony Excellence. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about really heavy things. But this past week, so many amazing things have happened, so many things worth highlighting that we felt like we can dedicate a whole segment to that. So we're gonna enjoy some accomplishments today, do some celebrating. And of course, we're going to have our own dedicated Ebony Excellence as well. Let's see what else we have to stick around for. Our Baba Become a Better Ally this week is excellent. And we're going to tell a story about a woman who made history before Rosa Parks did. Her name is Elizabeth Jennings Graham. And I promise you'll definitely want to stick around for that story for our Way Black History Fact. But first and foremost, I think it's time to get into some Ebony Excellence. Q, how do you feel about that?
Shall we?
We shall. So our first Ebony Excellence that we'll be discussing this week is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media. And the story comes from the LA Times. And we are shouting out once again on the show, the one, the only Beyoncé. And I will read. Beyoncé has broken the record for most lifetime Grammy wins with 32. With her victories for dance, electronic music recording, traditional R&B performance, best R&B song, and dance electronic music album, Beyoncé surpassed late classical conductor Greg Solti, who won 31 Grammys. She entered the night with 28 Grammys, and she is the most nominated artist on Earth. She has 88 nominations, and that's a distinction that she shares with her husband, Jay-Z. Her career triumph came in the wake of her 2022 album Renaissance, which dipped into 90s dance music, 70s disco, modern electronic music, and classic R&B in a virtuosic, sprawling ode to Black queer club culture. And there are those of us who feel that she should have won Album of the Year. And if you know anything about the Beehive, you know that that's not a small amount of people. I can't pretend that I'm the biggest Beyoncé fan. I am a huge fan, but you know, there are certainly people who know more about her career and just everything about her and all that she embodies than I do. But I definitely recognize Ebony Excellence when I see it, and that's why she's been the subject of our Ebony Excellence feature maybe 5 times now. So once again, credit where it's due. Shout out to Beyoncé, the most awarded Grammy winner in history of the Grammys. But it don't stop there.
And it shouldn't.
That way. Because as I mentioned, we're going to spend some time this episode talking about Ebony Excellence. Now, I want to take a moment and let you know a little bit about radio. So, you know, our show, we didn't start off doing Civic Cypher. We started off doing typical hip hop radio shows, DJing, you know, throwing to, you know, commercial breaks, teasing, you know, for folks to come back, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? We wanted to make this show kind of consistent with that format. So Ebony Excellence was a feature we thought really helped us to anchor this to positivity and a positive momentum with the show that really dealt with some heavy subjects, right? But we always knew that 2 minutes per hour per week wasn't enough. And that always felt like a sacrifice that we had to make. I'm speaking for both of us, but you know, a sacrifice we had to make because of course we had to deal with a lot of more pressing issues, I guess.
We knew it wasn't enough, but I think one of the first things you said is that it wasn't nothing, because we didn't always have a segment of the show that made us smile. Like, it was just the things that we had to talk about. And you and I both agree, like, it can't just be that.
Yeah.
Even when that's all that we're being given, we have to seek out
some reason to be happy. Yeah. And I think a reason to, you know, for folks that are listening to our show every week and not Black, we felt like it was important to not just be the source of, or like, I wouldn't even know how to say it, just constantly wallowing in our own misery, effectively, is what I'm trying to say. We do smile, we do celebrate, we are happy, we do accomplish amazing things. And at the same time, the other side of that coin is that we deal with a reality that is problematic at points. And, you know, both of those things can be true. And a lot of what we were learning at the time when the show was initially conceived is that many people who really do celebrate Black culture and Black people, and they love Black people, they don't really have access to meaningful access to the other side of that coin. They don't recognize the struggles. They just think, well, Obama did it, why can't you do it? You know, Beyonce did it, why can't you do it? You know, and that's a very unfair approach, because not everybody is Beyonce talented, let's be honest, but also there's a significant amount of what you may end up calling luck. It's not luck, but you know, luck that goes into these stories where people that have these talents or have these gifts or whatever, that they actually peek through and make it to the end of that long journey.
I think you're more right than you realize though, like the luck part, because you can work very hard and be very talented
and still not make it. We know plenty of stories like that.
Yeah. So I think that I don't want to downplay the luck part. And you can call it luck, you can call it prayer, you can call it divine intervention, but it's not just you.
Yeah,
it's not just you were dope and worked really hard, so you made it. It doesn't work that way.
Right. There's definitely some divine alignment, even for the show that we're talking about now, our show, Civic Cypher. For us to be as successful with this endeavor, there had to be some people along the way who, despite having a different opinion, a different political philosophy, persuasion, et cetera, you know, had to green light our ability to talk to you right now. And, you know, most of the people would not even want that. They would not even encourage the conversations that we're having because it does not reflect their worldview. I'm happy to say that many of them have kind of moved a little bit more toward the center since kind of dipping their toe in these Civic Cypher waters and subscribing to the Cypher Life along with me and Q here.
But one time for the Cypher Life.
Yes, sir. But yeah, we needed to make sure that we represented a full spectrum of what it meant to be Black and brown and indigenous and so forth. We hold this space for our brothers and sisters, our AAPI brothers and everyone else who maybe they don't have a space like this. We do believe in solidarity here, but primarily it is a Black space. It was conceived to be a Black space. And we needed to not misrepresent our people here. And so Ebony Excellence was something that we had to work into. We wanted to and had to work into this. They're called clocks. This radio terminology, we had to work it into our clock as a segment so that we had a bright moment.
Mm-hmm.
And
we had to commit ourselves to having a bright moment.
There you go.
Because it'd be easy to get lost
in just woe is me or woe is us. And then, you know, you guys would be tuning out like, oh, it's such a drag listening to that. We're happy people. We celebrate. We love. We live. We play with our children. Last night, my son was doing science experiments in my house. It was a little National Geographic science kit. Word. You know, we made memories last night. You know, this is no different, right? But, you know, you may not have glimpses into that beyond the more traumatic, troubling things you see in the news. And so, again, Ebony Excellence was meant to bring that balance. In fact, our positioners broadcast the balance and defend the discourse. So, dedicating a segment to it is something that feels long overdue. And so I want to make sure that we shine a light on some of these things that we believe are examples of Ebony Excellence. So first up is a woman named Ruth Simmons. So I'll read a bit about her. She was born Ruth Jean Stubblefield on July 3rd, 1945. She's an American professor and academic administrator. She is president of Prairie View A&M University, which is a historically Black university.
One time for the HBCUs.
Indeed. Now, the reason that we're talking about her today as an example of Ebony Excellence is because in her previous assignment, she served as the 18th president of Brown University. She did this from 2001 to 2012, where she was the first African-American president of an Ivy League institution. Not African-American woman, African-American person. And that happened in 2001, the Ivy League institution. Now, you know that there were brilliant Black minds prior to 2001.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hear the stories and they're incredible academics. But I think this shows that there's still sort of a good old boys club, not to take anything away from the people that deserve those positions, but it's hard to break in. It's hard to affect change. And we are now catching up, as illustrated by the first Black president of an Ivy League school happening in 2001. The effects of this type of trajectory in this country, this type of storyline in this country, the ripple effect is that now there's a battle on educating children under the guise of protecting children.
Somehow. There's a battle on books at this point, which is the really scary part. It's kind of happening under our nose, but right in front of our faces at the same time. Like the idea, I think there was like a book, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was called Fahrenheit 451 or Fahrenheit 415. Mm-hmm. It's the temperature at which pages burn.
Yep.
And the book, they made a movie about it, mm-hmm. about, you know, essentially destroying books. That was science fiction, mm-hmm. when it was written.
Ugh. Not now. And, you know, we're actually going to talk about that a little bit more later.
Oh, word.
Oh, yeah, word. Yeah. Because there's the second part of the show where we're going to talk about standpoint theory. There's a great example of that, and it uses an author whose books have been banned. She's mm-hmm. probably the most banned author, Toni Morrison.
And that's so dangerous.
Yeah.
Man.
So before we get there, still talking about Ebony Excellence, this one makes me very, very happy. You know, some of us call her auntie. And when you find out who it is, you'll know why. Viola Davis has officially achieved the coveted EGOT status. And just so you know, this part for Viola Davis, I'm pulling from the Black Information Network. She won at the Grammys this year as well. And she took home the award for Best Audiobook Narration and Storytelling Recording.
Have you had a chance to hear it yet?
I have not. Have you?
It's incredible.
Yeah, I believe it. Well, the thing is, I know she's an incredible actor, so she's goodness. Reading her own book.
Yes,
she's probably
going
to sell it, right? But I knew going into that she was up for an EGOT. Now, for those who don't know, EGOT is...
Well, Emmy. I don't want you to say for an EGOT, because it's not a singular thing that
yeah,
you win.
For the EGOT, yeah. I guess, which is the quadruple crown, if you will. So these are all prestigious awards that very few individuals get all four of them. This is like you're cemented in entertainment history with an elite few. Hmm. And this is not just box office success or album sales or anything like that, which are all well and good. This is recognized by your peers, I believe, and by the community, the entertainment community at large, as having made significant contributions in multiple veins of entertainment, mm-hmm. and so it suffice it to say it's quite coveted. Whoopi Goldberg is an EGOT winner, and she won all of the EGOT awards, and so that's kind of the benchmark. And
remind the audience what EGOT stands for.
Absolutely. So it's Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Emmy being for television.
Yes, sir.
So you have to be recognized as an elite performer in television and win that award. Grammy, of course, is music, and this is what Viola Davis won this year. Oscar, of course, as you know, is for movies. So she's an Oscar winner, which any one of these by themselves
yes.
is an incredible accomplishment.
Yes.
You know, just to be nominated, that's something that follows you through the rest of your career.
Yes, but indeed.
To win them is, you know, it puts you, so to win all four, so hopefully this is making sense. And then a Tony is for stage performances.
Yes.
So like a live, like Broadway theater, you have to win an award for your performance in a live arena. And so you can imagine how difficult this is to accomplish. And so only a handful of people have actually done it. Now Viola Davis has done it. And I can't say it enough. That's absolutely a glowing example of Ebony Excellence. I will say this last bit. This is from NBC News. She's quoted as saying, "It's been such a journey. I just got an EGOT. And if you wanted to find the book, and I need to find it myself, the audiobook is called Find Me. And that's the one that got the 2023 Grammy Award. So shout out to Viola Davis. Now, Autumn Lockwood, we're gonna shift gears here because, you know,
it's Super Bowl time,
and we're in the city where the Super Bowl is taking place, you know, putting our show together this week. So I want to make sure that we acknowledge that, but also we acknowledge the people who are involved, so you understand why it's important to us, but also that it's important to us not just because it's here, but because of the people involved. So I want Q, why don't you take this next one, because we're again getting into the sports arena, and that's a little bit beyond.
The interesting thing about Coach Lockwood is that she's in a space where the organizations in the National Football League have, with very little resistance, been able to almost exclusively promote, hire, and employ white men in positions of power and leadership, and just being able to point to what they consider not just the talent pool, but the those who are in waiting and those who are being groomed, as if the only people that fit into those positions are white men, even though the talent pool of players is predominantly African American. For there to not just be a black person, but a black woman in a position in the NFL, it's hard because you want to give them credit for hiring her. But just like you said earlier with Ruth Simmons, man, it took too long, right? For 2023 to be the first time, like, we shouldn't still be having these first, but I don't want to rain on this parade. I do want to celebrate her. Autumn is an assistant sports performance coach for the Philadelphia Eagles, who just arrived in Arizona for the Super Bowl a few days ago. She will take the field as the first black woman to coach in the Super Bowl when her team faces off against the Kansas City Chiefs Sunday, February 12th. Lockwood, a graduate of the University of Arizona, shout out to the Cats, Bear Down, and a former soccer player, broke into the industry as a sports information director and Olympic strength and conditioning coach at her alma mater. Lockwood went on to work with the University of Houston as a sports performance coordinator in 2021. She continued her line of work as a strength and conditioning assistant at East Tennessee State, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV, and with the Atlanta Falcons before joining the Eagles in August of 2022.
You know, I want to say something. For those of you listening, these conversations that we're having are important, but I have to remind you, I do this probably every two or three shows, I want to remind you again that none of this comes from a place of anger. Some of it is like our coming to terms with the reality, our realizing, dang, that's never happened before now. Wow, the system is more broken than we originally thought, or, you know, this, how can this be? You know, and I recognize that if we're playing a numbers game, more men are interested in football overall than are all women. But, you know, you're absolutely right. There, if we're looking at the color line, there are overwhelmingly more people in those thinking, planning, strategizing, leading positions in football organizations. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's, strictly speaking, where the concentration of talent is. That's just where the opportunities are focused. This is my understanding of how it has come together.
Yes.
That's where we are in 2023. And I think it was further illustrated when I saw Deion Sanders interacting with his students that he was coaching. What a good man he is and a good role model he is. And I can't imagine that there could be a more effective role model for the class that he was talking to in the clips that I've seen, the classes where he's just up there being and saying and teaching and being an example of what they can aspire to. And that means something. And oftentimes people that end up in that position don't look like him, don't have his perspective, don't understand what some of those kids might be up against with their aunties and cousins still starving and, you know, living different lifestyles and so forth, and what
challenges may be ahead for some of these folks. And so,
especially at his former employer, he was the head coach at Jackson State in Mississippi. I'm still sad we didn't get a chance to go down there while he was still there. But, you know, Jackson didn't have clean drinking water. And he had to coach and educate these kids and get them prepared to go play a game.
While
getting an education. Like, it's more than a notion, man. But
I'm glad that there's progress. Yes. So I wanted to say that we're moving in the right direction. Just because we're saying this stuff doesn't mean that we're mad about the past. We're just acknowledging it. We're excited about the future and the direction we're going in.
Yes, indeed.
All right, go ahead and knock out that last one.
This comes from CNN. Both Patrick Mahomes and Jalen Hurts spoke to the media on Thursday as they recognized the significance of being the first two black quarterbacks to start in the same Super Bowl.
Boom.
Wow. Before I move on. Goodness gracious.
That's cool, man.
And, you know, being a former football player, you know, from five all the way through college.
I played football too.
I've heard those conversations. Rams did play football, about how they used to perceive black people that play this position or kept us from playing the position because they figured we didn't have the mental capacity to do the job.
You see what I mean? That's what we have to talk about.
So once again, I'm not raining on these celebratory moments, just giving you guys some context as to why it's a big deal.
Yeah. These are good things, though.
Almost exactly 35 years after Doug Williams became the first black quarterback to start and win a Super Bowl with the then Washington Redskins. They are now the Washington Commanders, I believe, because it took them this long to realize Redskins probably wasn't the best name for your team.
Probably the worst name.
With an Aboriginal face on the side of the helmet, but we'll move on. For 27-year-old Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes, he's looking at his second Super Bowl, looking to win his second, as the teams face off on February 12th, which would make him the first black quarterback to win multiple Super Bowl titles. So either way, this is going to be a moment in history.
Yeah.
And Patrick, for what it's worth, might be the best we've ever seen play the position.
Great.
Even and that's better. Not Q's opinion. That's kind of
general consensus.
There's Tom Brady, who's considered the GOAT, and then there's this kid who they think might be the only person to ever have a chance to give him a run for his money.
Well, I can't wait to see what happens. Also, I want to acknowledge this, that we're recording this before February 12th, of course.
Yes.
You know, some stations air our show at different times around the country, but either way, we're really excited about this. We do believe that these are amazing examples of ebony excellence. This is a celebratory, jovial moment for both of us, and it should be for you as well. And welcome to our reality, because even when we're happy, it's sometimes a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
So if you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I am your host, Ramses Jha.
He is Ramses Jha. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
Mm-hmm. A lot more to stick around for, so please do. We're going to spend some time discussing standpoint theory. Yeah. So this is something that is new to me. It's an old theory. I think it originated in maybe the 70s or something like that. But we just came across it and we sat with it and we thought maybe this is a good way to explain some things to our listeners. Certainly it helped us explain some things to ourselves, some things that we were seeing. And we like things like that, things that challenge our way of thinking and help us expand our mental framework. And if you are one of the people that likes that sort of thing, then definitely stick around for that. And of course, much, much more. But first and foremost, we're going to start off with becoming a better ally. B-A-B-A, Baba. And today's Baba is sponsored by Major Threads. Get all the finest in menswear and sportswear at majorthreads.com. This article comes from Black Information Network. You can find that at binnews.com. And we are going to shout out for becoming a better ally. An amazing man. I love this guy. I spent a lot of time skateboarding when I was in high school, man. And when I was in grade school.
So this is the coolest dude in the world to you at one point.
And when I was in grade school, he actually had bikes. And I was in like GTs and dynos and that sort of stuff back in the day. Anyway, he had a Tony Hawk bike. Anyway, Tony Hawk. He has pledged to donate proceeds from autographed photos to a memorial fund for Tyree Nichols, whose family said shares the same passion as a skateboarding legend. On February 3rd, Hawk said he and BMX rider Rick Thorne would autograph pictures to raise money for Tyree Nichols Memorial Fund, which was launched after the 29-year-old black man was fatally beaten by Memphis police, per the Associated Press. Here's a quote from him. My proceeds from these will go to the Tyree Nichols Memorial Fund, which includes plans to build a public skate park in his honor as our worlds continue to grieve his loss, Hawk tweeted Friday. He goes on. He was a talented skater among other admirable traits. Let's keep his legacy alive. That man did not have to do that. Tony Hawk is a good man. People like him go to heaven. All right. Nichols, an avid skateboarder and father to a four-year-old boy, died on January 10th, 3 days after he was pulled over by Memphis police officers. Footage released earlier this month shows officers repeatedly punching, kicking, and hitting him with a baton as he cried out for his mother. Six officers involved in the deadly traffic stop, blah, 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 whatever. Half of the proceeds from the talk Hawk and Thorne's autograph photos will go toward helping Nichols' family, building a skate park in his name, and honoring his love for skateboarding. So that's how you can become a better ally. Do like Tony Hawk, man. I love that one. All right. Standpoint theory. While I'm here, I pulled this in as layman's terms as I could find from Britannica.com, but I implore you to take standpoint theory, put that in your lap, and at a point when you have some time, read it. Read the cerebral academic version of it. I would never be able to articulate it here on this show. I wouldn't have the time. I don't even know if, you know, my understanding of it is as profound as it could be. We have some, certainly have some talking points that I want to share with you. But first, I want to start with a story. I go for walks with some frequency. We'll call it 5 days a week. In, let's be honest, an affluent neighborhood. And I have friends who never have to worry about money. In fact, they don't have to worry about money so much so that they don't even think about it. And their worldview is insulated by their means and privilege. These people are good people. And for a long time, I could not understand fully, and I'm still learning, I'll admit that, but I could not understand fully how, you know, some people could vote for such and such or could have these ideas that center, you know, profits over people, or were so susceptible to what I would consider to be fear-mongering, things that are not based in reality. You know, we talked about it earlier. Oh, CRT is scaring children. We've been teaching American history to children since there have been children. All of a sudden, because of, what is it, the Great Replacement Theory taking center stage and far right QAnon message boards online, you know, people are trying to educate children, or rather uneducate, leave, what is it, what's the word I'm looking for? Fail to educate children so that they do not become sympathetic and empathetic. And they use the guise of, oh, this hurts white children's feelings, to appeal to folks who have no practical, valid, certainly not substantial experience walking a path that shows full well that these notions are unfounded, entirely unfounded, right? But good people, well-intentioned, well-meaning people, I'm learning myself crazy. I had a conversation recently with a woman, beautiful woman, beautiful woman. I don't want to put her business out there, but she knows who she is. She listens to the show. And while she's listening, I will say again that I love you and I thank you for this inspiration for today's segment. shoot, you may come up one day. Who knows? She's talking to me and she says, why is no one listening to each other? Why are we not making progress? How is the world the way that it is? Why is it not simpler? She's asking questions that deserve to be asked. Okay.
That deserve to be answered.
And answered, absolutely. And I'm at a loss for words. I'm like, you know, if it was that simple, people would have figured it out long before I got here. And she says, like me, she's like, well, she says, you know, Black people are my angels. I promise she's a person that does not need to say that. She says, Black people have always been kind to me in my life. Black people have always looked out for me, cared for me when I needed it. Black people are my angels. And I wish that the world was better for all of us, right? And it's so simple, but you know, how do we get there? Enter standpoint theory. All right, so first and foremost, I will speak for myself. I believe that Q is of a similar persuasion, but I will speak for myself first and foremost. I often speak for you and I just assume. So one of my heroes, historical heroes, is a man named Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton is known for, let's be honest, now he's known for getting killed by the police in Chicago, assassinated by the police in Chicago. That's a fact. That is not me embellishing. Assassinated by the Chicago police. Look that up. They admitted it, okay? But when he was alive, he was a very charismatic person. He was around during the time of the Panthers and so forth. And he had this idea and this sort of movement. It was referred to as the Rainbow Coalition. And the idea there was that he took ideas. He basically took everyone who had a struggle in this country and sat them all down at a table with Black people to say, okay, my Asian brothers and sisters, my Jewish brothers and sisters, we haven't forgotten you, my indigenous native brothers and sisters, my Hispanic brothers and sisters, you know, my LGBTQIA plus brothers and sisters, of course they weren't called that back then, all of us have something to gain by creating a meaningful social impact, and we can create that change more easily and more effectively together in unison. So we're greater than the sum of our parts, right? This Rainbow Coalition was something that I really believed in and believe in right now. And again, I'm speaking for Q, if I may, that this is something, okay, he's nodding his head. This is something that we appreciate on the show. With that in mind, I will say this. The standpoint theory is a feminist theory. And I will credit the author in just a minute. So this does not originate with, a Black power movement or struggle, rather a feminist struggle. But the idea is sound. And, you know, people that are looking to create a better world oftentimes look at historical change makers, and far be it from us to ignore our sisters and the progress that they've made in their struggles. And I know that our sisters and everyone looks at what Black people do to try to move the needle. Everyone else who was kind of born with a strike against them, because we have been traveling this road for a very long time and have made meaningful progress throughout history. So today we're taking a page out of the Book of Feminism, and standpoint theory is a feminist theoretical perspective that argues that knowledge stems from social position. That's important because, if you don't know, it doesn't sound like anything. But if you break it down, knowledge stems from social position. Think about that. You would think, as I would think, that knowledge stems from academics. But where do academics come from? Often academics come from means, privilege, access, etc. And they cannot, in a meaningful way, articulate
the reality and solutions and approaches for people who have not, where they have not lived in their shoes, right? So this presupposes that your perspective is based on where you are in society. Okay, so we have to accept that, and I do believe that there is some truth there. Again, I'm not purporting this to be a reality. It's a theory that I believe works in helping us expand our mental framework and how we choose to approach problems. Like my friend asked me, how do we approach these problems? If you're not from that position, maybe we could listen to people from that position. This is the point I'm trying to make, and I'll continue to make it here. All right, so the theory emerged from the Marxist,
There's another one of those words that our country, our government, our leaders have made taboo with no context. You hear it, you think it's bad, and that's it.
Thank you.
There's no research, there's no studying, there's no learning.
Get him.
That word is bad, just like socialist, just like communist, just like, and I'm not saying that any of these words are good or bad. I'm just saying there's an auto association with bad when we hear them,
yeah,
with no understanding of what they actually mean.
And in principle, these things are all good in principle. In practice, they all have their advantages and disadvantages, yeah, and indeed so does capitalism.
Yeah, and they've been classified the way that they have been intentionally for people to not push back or question the idea of capitalism, which is what we subscribe to, right? What we subscribe to is better. Our religion, our class system, our, you know, way of government, our way of economics is better. And to keep you guys from asking us too many questions or wanting to venture into trying some other way, we'll just make we'll just make all those other ways bad.
Right.
And if we say that they're bad enough times for long enough, you'll just agree with us and never ask us any questions.
And I think that's important. You know, I refer to myself as a decadent capitalist pig from time to time because I have a sports car and, you know, live in a decent part of town and have watches that are more expensive than they need to be. But I also recognize that I can live in this country and be critical of certain parts of this country. That's not to say that in socialist societies that people don't, you know, accomplish great things. I'm a sharer by my very nature, and there's a way to walk that line. But the way things have been marketed to us in this country, and I'll admit that I've been, you know, marketed to as well, and I had to unlearn a lot of things and relearn what I now know, and the whys of why I was taught what I was taught, so that I didn't have to feel awful about myself. I didn't have to feel like, you know, there's only one way to do things. And so I'm grateful for things like this. I'm grateful for people like you who was able to articulate when I said, you know, and I got to Karl Marx's name and I was like, uh-oh, and he jumped in there, because these things often our emotions are manipulated so that we continue to prop up the capitalists, right? And while I and all of us are capitalists in practice, the real capitalists are the ones who are really benefiting from this society, and the people at the bottom of the society, the people that their lives are ruined because their mother is sick, you know what I mean, and they have to, you know, like that sort of thing, to keep those people from pushing back, from revolting, as I mentioned, you know, there's powerful forces that market to us fear, you know. Jim Carrey said something recently, and he's like, why is it that everyone in America is afraid of the socialist healthcare that we have in Canada? For those that don't know, Jim Carrey's Canadian. He's like, in my whole life, I've never waited in line. I've never had to worry about anything. All my medicine was paid for. Why in the world? What is the point of a government? What is the point of a government if not to take care of things like this? And in America, we have this idea
the people on the ground level are like, just do it yourselves. I did it myself. You do it yourself. And we're not caring for each other. And it's because we think this is the only way that it has to be, because we're afraid of doing it any other way, when we literally have examples around the world where it's just fine.
It's not just fear, though. The intentional misinformation part counts.
Say
right?
It.
They present that there was some politician, and I'm not leaving out a name to be vague. I just don't remember who it was, mm-hmm. that their whole thing was, they're going to take your health care from you.
Isn't that crazy?
And he was saying that about the people that were trying to give you healthcare, right? His argument was, they're going to take away your choice for your own healthcare provider that you have to pay for,
which isn't strictly true,
and give you one for free,
which isn't strictly true. But
even if that was absolutely true,
they make it seem like it's the worst thing.
To position it that way was very intentional. So it wasn't just making people afraid. Is making people angry. Let's tell them the wrong thing, but let's say it really loud and really confidently, and they'll just accept it.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to take this from you. Well, say the rest of it, sir. They're proposing making it something that you don't have to go without.
I think this is the same thing that happened with CRT, or better said, American history, teaching American history in school. Again, I watched at Solano Elementary School in the fourth grade, Roots, all of them. For those that don't know, there was this movie that came out, or it was like a TV docu, it wasn't a docu-series, but like a TV,
it was a TV
saga
series.
Yeah. 5-6 episodes, 8 episodes, something like that. It was called Roots. And it starred LeVar Burton from Reading Rainbow and Star Trek, Geordi LaForge, my man. Anyway, Kunta Kinte. We watched that in class. And I was the kid who was black on free lunch.
How about that?
You know what I'm saying? And I didn't feel bad about watching that. I mean, I had to learn to be proud of it, but I accepted it. I realized that it wasn't me. It was a long time ago. It was fine. You know, but now what has been sold to the public is, we need to protect our children from these, you know, these radical thinkers. And so, you know, we're going to get there, but I'll continue. I'll continue. This theory emerged from the Marxist argument that people from an oppressed class have special access to knowledge that is not available to those from a privileged class. I think that's absolutely true. If you don't know what government cheese tastes like, if you didn't have rats in your house, if you didn't have roaches in your house, if there wasn't shooting outside of your house 2 to 3 times a week, if you ain't never seen a dead body in the street where you live, you can't tell me about Compton because I was there. You have no idea what it feels like, what it feels like to think at age 6 that the important age is not 18, not 21, but 20. The important age is 20. Why is that? Because the stories you hear all the time at age 6, oh, such and such died. He was only 13. She was only 17. He was only 19. Teen, 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 teen. So I thought, if I could just make it to 20, then I will have made it. Those of you that can't see me, I have a big old afro on my hair. I started growing that afro when I turned 20 years old because I made it. I didn't live in Compton until I was 20, but that number stuck with me. I didn't start smoking cigarettes when I turned 18, never smoked a cigarette. I didn't start drinking when I turned 21, never drank alcohol in my life. For me, the important age was 20. Do you know what that feels like? Then how can you educate me? I need to educate you. This standpoint theory, the presupposition is that you don't know everything. I want to read this. The philosophy examines the nature and origins of knowledge and stresses that knowledge is always socially situated. Sandra Harding, credit where it's due, coined the term standpoint theory to categorize epistemologies that emphasize women's knowledge. She argued that it is easy for those at the top of social hierarchies to lose sight of real human relations and the true nature of social reality, and thus miss critical questions about the social and natural world in their academic pursuits. In contrast, people at the bottom of social hierarchies have a unique standpoint that is a better starting point for scholarship. Although such people are often ignored, their marginalized positions actually make it easier for them to divine important research questions and explain social and natural problems. I want to say this. Toni Morrison, the one we were talking about who got all her books banned, had a masterful response to an interview. It was like an early 90s interview. There was a white woman interviewing her. The woman asks her, well, will you ever write about white authors? Can you ever conceive of a time when white authors will make their way into your work? And she says, I have done that. But more importantly, you have no idea how racist a question like that is to me. The interviewer looks perplexed, right? And you would think, well, why is she saying everything? Why has everything got to be racist? Here's what she says. Toni Morrison says to her, if I was a white author, would you ask me that question? When am I going to write about black people in my books? Your question assumes that the norm, the status quo, is white. And therefore, by definition, is racist. It's based on race. It's a Eurocentric approach. You are the center of the earth, and I'm doing something that you don't feel centered in, and therefore somehow you need to make it about you. And she didn't say that, but that's effectually what was communicated. She was extremely pleasant. She didn't raise her nothing. She had to play her position, rightfully so. She couldn't act the fool on TV, and I don't think that she would. That probably is not her way. But you start to understand where you are in society, where you come from in society, where your vantage point is, absolutely informs your viewpoint. If you've been centered your whole life, how can you speak about Compton, California? And shout out to the D one time, to the motor, to the 313. Right now it's time for the Way Black History Fact. That was heavy. Today's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. Yank this off of Wikipedia so you can start there if you want to make sure I'm telling you the truth. If not, you know, the research is all out there. But please read more about these people. We're going to bring somebody to life that you may not have heard of before. She is the woman who came before Rosa Parks. That'll make sense. I'm not talking about Rosa Parks' mom. I'm talking about pioneer. And her name is Elizabeth Jennings Graham. I'll read. Elizabeth Jennings Graham, March 1830 through June 5th, 1901. That means she lived during a hard time. Was an African-American teacher and civil rights figure. In 1854, Graham insisted on her right to ride on an available New York City streetcar at a time when all such companies were private and most operated segregated cars. Her case was decided in her favor in 1855, and it led to the eventual desegregation of all New York City transit systems by 1865. Graham later started the city's first kindergarten for African-American children, operating it from her home on 247 West 41st Street until her death in 1901. By the 1850s, the horse-drawn streetcar on rails became a more common mode of transportation, competing with the horse-drawn omnibus in the city. Elevated heavy rail transportation did not go into service in New York until 1869. Like the nearly obsolete omnibus lines, the streetcars were owned by private companies, which regularly barred access to their service on the basis of race. The owners and drivers could easily refuse service to passengers of African descent or demand racially segregated seating. On Sunday, July 16, 1854, Jennings went to the first colored congregational church where she was an organist. As she was running late, she boarded a streetcar of the Third Avenue Railroad Company at the corner of Pearl Street and Chatham Street. I think that's how I say that. The conductor ordered her to get off. When she refused, the conductor tried to remove her by force. Eventually, with the aid of a police officer, Jennings was ejected from the streetcar. Horace Greeley's New York Tribune commented on the incident in February 1855. She got upon one of the company's cars last summer on the Sabbath to ride to church. The conductor undertook to get her off, first alleging the car was full. When that was shown to be false, he pretended the other passengers were displeased at her presence. But when she insisted on her rights, he took hold of her by force to expel her. She resisted. The conductor got her down on the platform, jammed her bonnet, soiled her dress, and injured her person. Quite a crowd gathered, but she effectually resisted. Finally, after the car had gone on further, with the aid of a policeman, they succeeded in removing her. The incident sparked an organized movement among Black New Yorkers to end racial discrimination on streetcars, led by notables such as Jennings' father, Reverend James W.C. Pennington, and Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. Her story was publicized by Frederick Douglass in his newspaper, and it received national attention. Jennings' father filed the lawsuit on behalf of his daughter against the driver, the conductor, and the Third Avenue Railroad Company in Brooklyn, where the Third Avenue Company was headquartered. This was one of four streetcar companies franchised in the city and had been in operation for about 1 year. She was represented by the law firm of Culver, Parker, and Arthur. Her case was handled by the firm's 24-year-old junior partner, Chester A. Arthur, future president of the United States. In 1855, the court ruled in her favor. In his charge to the jury, Brooklyn Circuit Court Judge William Rockwell declared, "Colored persons, if sober, well-behaved, and free from disease, had the same rights as others and could be neither excluded by any rules of the company nor by force or violence." The jury awarded Jennings damages in the amount of $250, which is the equivalent of $7,300 in today's money, as well as $22.50 in costs. The next day, the Third Avenue Railroad Company ordered its cars desegregated. As important as the Jennings case was, it did not mean that all streetcar lines would desegregate. Leading African-American activists formed the New York Legal Rights Association to continue the fight. In May 1855, James W.C. Pennington, brought suit after being forcefully removed from the car of the 8th Avenue Railroad, another of the first four companies. After steps forward and back, a decade later in 1865, New York's public transit services were fully desegregated. The last case was a challenge by a Black woman named Ella Anderson. Thank you for listening. These are names you need to know because these people fought. And it's important to say their names. So Ella Anderson, a widow of a fallen United States colored troops soldier, a fact that won public support for her. All right. On January 2nd, 2018, Jennings' first biography was published, written by Amy Hill Hurt, entitled Streetcar Justice, How Elizabeth Jennings Won the Right to Ride in New York. And intended for middle grade to adult readers, the book was published by HarperCollins Green Willow Books in New York. Jerry Micarenda authored America's First Freedom Rider, Elizabeth Jennings, Chester A. Arthur, and the Early Fight for Civil Rights, about the legal fight which arose from her forcible removal out of the streetcar. Published in December 2019 by Rowan and Littlefield. And in 2019, Shirlane McRae announced that New York City would build a statue honoring Graham near Grand Central Terminal. So, like we said, you know, it's important for us to discuss Ebony Excellence because that's important. We get an hour with you every week. You're probably on a station that uses Black culture in a meaningful way. And
if nothing else, in a profitable way.
Yes. And even if that's not the case, we appreciate our hour with you. We realize that that's not nothing. And in that time, we have to make you smile. We have to make you think. And we also have to acknowledge that we are, a lot of people recently have tried to make us into heroes, and we look back and we see our heroes and we see real heroes. We see people like this, you know, Elizabeth Jennings Graham, Ella Anderson, you know. So the way Black History Fact is very important too. It's a very important segment and an important part of our clock. We appreciate the opportunity we have to share this stuff with you. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I knew all this stuff. I'm learning with you in many of these
instances. We learn a lot from this segment every week.
A lot we do know, but a lot of it we're learning in real time with you. So, not as heavy of a show as we normally have, but hopefully made some impact. That's about it for us here on Civic Cypher. So once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. To say we appreciate you guys really doesn't say enough.
Yeah, man. If you're here with us and you're trying to learn and trying to do better and trying to expand your way of thinking, that's something. I won't even say that's not nothing. That's something special. You know, and we're your brothers and we love you. It doesn't matter what you look like. Doesn't matter what you did yesterday. We're going to figure it out together, right?
That's the mission.
Yeah, man. And same as Cheryl. Oh, I said I wasn't going to say her name, but same as my friend, Cheryl. We're all learning together and we're all going to build something special, I believe. And it starts with things like this. So again, we do appreciate you listening. Hit the website, Civic Cypher, submit any questions, topics you want us to cover, make a donation. The show is growing. Your support certainly helps us grow on our way. Follow us on all social media at Civic Cypher. You can follow me at Ramses Ja. Q is I am Q Ward. And until next week, y'all.
Peace. Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you a rhyme travelers. Worlds is spit tunes from sunlight to moon. Busting off stage like gunfights and moons. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show. Get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines. Wake up, refuse, and resist. Like this.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A